On this episode of Skeptico,
you can look at history and realize that the same kind of mystery that we can experience or search for today has probably been the defining kind of quest of mankind. So I actually think, like, the question rather than the answer is the answer. I find the comfort in being able to look back over essentially 70,000 years of human history and go, well, they're dealing with it as well. They're dealing with grief and spirit contact and telepathy and this much bigger, richer tasting, exciting universe, just as we are or can be. And also, it's okay if you don't have the answer because, you know, we've been looking for 70,000 years.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and while putting together this episode of Skeptico, I kept thinking of this terrific new movie I saw recently called The Big Short. If you haven't heard about it, it's an only slightly Hollywoodized version of what happened during the economic crash of 2008. Now, my favorite character in the movie is the socially awkward surgeon-turned-hedge fund manager, Dr. Michael Burry. And he's quite a character, and he's quite a character in real life, too. I've read some interviews with him. And Burry's big claim to fame, as portrayed in the movie, is that he was one of the few people to see the coming collapse of the real estate market. And more importantly, he was a hedge fund manager who was willing to bet hundreds of millions of dollars of his hedge fund on his analysis of the data. Now, a little backstory here to fill in the situation. This is 2005. The U.S. housing market is absolutely booming. In fact, it's booming so much that some people are getting a little bit skittish and wondering, how long can this boom last? Well, what Burry did is he followed the data, wherever it leads. In this case, he started analyzing the mortgages behind these complex financial instruments that were being sold on Wall Street. And then he analyzed what he found. That is that many, many of these mortgages that were being touted as rock-solid, safe investments were, in fact, really risky. So the reason I bring this up is probably at this point rather obvious. Here's a guy who followed the data, wherever it leads. But for me, the real skeptical point in the movie comes when the market starts to turn. So in the case of the economic meltdown, it becomes 2007, and now it's clear to everyone that the real estate market is faltering. There's more and more foreclosures, more and more signs of instability in the market. But what happens? Well, in a scene that might be lost to a lot of moviegoers, there's a point relatively early on where Burry's ready to cash in his trade. He's bet that the market's going to crash, the market is starting to crash, and he's willing to take his hedge fund profits and go home. So he calls up Goldman Sachs, who originally took his bet, and he said, okay, look, it's obvious, the market is crashing, let's negotiate a sale, let's settle this bet. And Goldman Sachs doesn't call him back. And he tries again, and they still won't call him back. And when he finally reaches them, they say, well, you know, we're not really sure how to price your investment. In other words, we're not ready to acknowledge the fact that the real estate market is crashing. It's a great point in the movie because it shows not only is the mortgage-backed securities system corrupt, but the entire investment banking system is corrupt at a level that no one could have even imagined. Now, as the story turns out, what Goldman Sachs does is just find some other chump to sell their investment to, and then they're more than willing to go back to Burry and buy his investment so they can resell it to someone else. So this is at a point when they've switched sides now and said, okay, the collapse is imminent. How can we make money off of that? So the reason I bring all this up and the way I think it's relevant to today's interview with Gordon White, author of a terrific new book, Starships, is that, as you know, it's not enough to just follow the data wherever it leads. It's a matter of trusting your analysis of that data, even when everyone around you denies it. I mean, isn't that the situation we face with materialism? It's a crazy idea from almost any angle you look at it, and we've talked about this so many times in the show, but if you look at mainstream science, there's very little breaking of ranks. But that doesn't mean our analysis is wrong. materialism, this idea that you are a biological robot in a meaningless universe, that you have no real love for anyone, that you have no real experience other than these random chemical reactions in your brain, is an idiotic idea. And that's what's so great about Gordon White's book. Because what Gordon does is start with what we already know, that materialism has been falsified. And from there, dares to re-examine and recalibrate what we might find from analyzing all this data, that is, the body of scientific evidence that we've collected. As you can tell, it's quite an undertaking, quite bold, to say you're going to do a redo on the origins of civilization. But if that's where the data takes us, well, somebody has to do it. Today we welcome author, blogger, and chaos magician Gordon White to Skeptico. Yes, I did say chaos magician, and we'll get to more of that in a minute because I think it's an important part of this story. But Gordon is the creator of runesoup.com, that's R-U-N-E, soup.com, and has published a terrific new book titled Starships, which seeks no less than to completely recalibrate our understanding of history and science based on a non-materialistic, magical perspective. So it's quite an undertaking, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Gordon, here to Skeptico.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, Alex. I'm a huge fan.
Well, thanks so much for saying that. You know, I joined you on your show and didn't know a lot about what was going on at Rune Soup. And then since then, I've just dived into it headfirst and enjoying it like crazy. The book is actually terrific. You know, I might even want to cut some of that out, though, because I always hate when people start an interview and they say, oh, wow, that book is so good. You know, here's the book, everybody. Buy this. This is the best book.
Also, it was out in paperback on Monday.
Yeah, it is a beautiful book, by the way. Just the one that you sent me is just absolutely stunningly beautiful. It's like, you know, my favorite Marshall McLuhan quote, you don't read the Sunday Times, you get into it like a warm bath. Well, that's how I feel kind of about that book. You just kind of are drawn into it. But that being said, I am a little bit torn on how to start this interview because I do feel we have to deal with this magician stuff because that is going to be very strange and unusual to folks. Let's be honest, it's going to be off-putting to a lot of folks, and I really want to deal with it head on. And at the same time, I don't want to get bogged down in it because the book is really not about magic, and despite the title, it's really not about UFOs either. And that's what's so wonderful about the breadth of the that you take in looking at this. So I want to talk about magic, and I want to talk about a magical perspective as it compares and contrasts with a reductionistic, scientific, materialistic kind of outlook. But let's start with the basics. Who you are, a little bit about your bio, and a little bit about this magician thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, I live in London, but I'm Australian born and raised, and I've lived a bunch of places. I've moved to New Zealand after working a bit in the music industry in Sydney, and I was there for about 7 years, and I've been here for about 8 years growing up because my family has some sort of Pacific connections. I spent a lot of time in Polynesia and some time in Melanesia and so on. So there's kind of a wider than Australian influence on myself growing up. And in terms of career, most of the stuff has been in media in particular. So from a demographics and data analysis point of view, there seems to have been a crossover of skills because I've spent the last 10 years doing essentially audience and demographic analysis, and there's quite a bit about population movements and so on in the book. So it's been a kind of funny combination or coalescing of family background and career skills and personal interest. And obviously the other one is magic, which has probably been well, not since before my family. That's technically impossible. But from about the age of 13, it's as a motif, it had been interesting before that to me. So one of my father's favorite sort of stories about me, however odd that sounds, is he had some friends over. I was six, and one of his friends asked if I was reading independently yet. And at that point, I walked by with the Lord of the Rings in my hand. And he thought that was quite funny. I mean, I read it at six. I understood, you know, not a vast amount of it. So in terms of a motif, I guess it was there. I've always liked history and mythology and that kind of thing. But the sort of decision to say, well, I'm going to take this seriously, happened one weekend when I was about 13.
What does that mean, take this seriously? What is a magician? What does that mean to you?
Right. Well, in my definition, I would consider magic to be a cultural understanding of the kind of innate consciousness and psi effects that are discussed quite often on Skeptico. These things are telepathy and after-death communication and that kind of stuff. So if you kind of think of it as being actively involved in the implications of that kind of research, because it does kind of, around the world, magic is used for a comparatively few number of things. It is used for after-death communication. It's used for, you know, seeing the future, for want of a better word, so a kind of remote viewing style model. It's used for probability enhancement, so making sure that when the hunting groups go out, they're more likely to come back with the deer than not. And across kind of human history, magic seems to be the word we've used for understanding consciousness effects in the universe that we hadn't had words like consciousness effect for previously. So that's what it is to me. It's kind of an animist way of seeing the world that's built on a lot of the things that we're now kind of seeing over the last 120 years of psi and consciousness research.
Yeah, but here's the problem. I mean, it's not just that, is it? Because let's, again, get real. A lot of people are going to have a very negative association with magic, and it's going to be tied up with our understanding of Christianity, our understanding of demonic forces, and all the rest of that. And I don't see you, like, really trying to push yourself away from that. I mean, your grimoires, yeah, you're going to explore that, and incantations, spells, tarot cards. It's not like you're saying these things can't be part of the equation too. You're just drawing, I think, a broader picture of how this magical worldview might really be, I don't know, recalibrated with our very materialistic worldview. So let's address that kind of head on, because I think it gets to really the essence of what your book is all about.
Yeah, sure. So the initial negative reaction to, say, the word magic is an exclusively late capitalist Western European and predominantly white view of it, because if you look on balance around the world, in other cultures, that's not necessarily the case. There are witch doctors and shamans and cunning men and people who, within a tribal or cultural group, do have that sort of trafficking with the spirit world role. We've kind of had
Let me interject because it's not, we don't have to just go to Africa and South America. I mean, the Catholic Church, and not disparaging the Catholic Church, is almost explicitly magical, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In a lot of its rituals and its, you know, and I thought in preparing for this, I was reminded of the book, The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. And it was written by this investigative journalist a few years ago, Matt, I can't remember his last name. But what he did, I mean, he's a very secular atheist type guy, and he went to the University of exorcism in Rome that the Catholic Church actually has. And, I mean, you want to talk about spells and incantations and rituals and stuff. And it's all directed at this thing that we're all familiar with, this idea of demonic possession, whatever that means. Sure. But, I mean, here is magic, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. And you could go further with the Catholic Church if you look at how the saints are officially and unofficially used. I mean, there's an entire folk magic tradition around saints, and now we have in Central America, say, Santa Muerte, which is this sort of female not death saint, that's the wrong word, but like a female depiction of death, which is a folk saint that the Catholic Church is saying, please stop using this. But it's literally the fastest growing religious belief in that part of the world. And you actually had, especially in, say, early modern Europe and late medieval Europe, where you had all these leftover priests because there were too many priests for the churches, people would pay for a requiem mass to be held for someone who was still alive. That was a curse. So they were paying Catholic priests to curse someone. So the magic's never really gone away. The squeamishness around it is, as I'm saying, is kind of like late capitalist Western version of it. Once, especially post-Vatican II, once we stripped what I think are all the fun bits out of Catholicism, all the kind of, the spells and the incense and the Latin and all the kind of drama pieces are all gone. And so we're left with this sort of really tasteless and bland and quite sort of psychologically violent version of Christianity, which people eventually grow out of. But in the meantime, they've missed the fact that globally on a cultural basis, this kind of interaction with the spirit world, which we now use terms like after-death communication and UFO or extra-dimensional entity or whatever you want to call it, we have new words for it. But this process, whatever it is quite long-lived, and that's sort of my definition of magic. We call magic the kind of rolling up of that interaction between mankind and something non-physical.
And that's what I really appreciated. I wish I could remember the exact clip, but it was in one of your interviews, and you really just kind of went off on this little rant about, hey, magic, I mean, at least it's breaking the spell of this crazy materialism. So the point I think you were making is that really, if we get past materialism and reductionism, the only thing left is magic, right? So it becomes Absolutely. A magical worldview, right?
Absolutely. It's just a question. So most people who have kind of, and I'll use the word spell, but most people who have broken the materialist spell, to my mind, they're non-practicing magicians because they live in a magical universe. They may be entirely disinclined for whatever reason, because it's certainly a niche interest. They may be entirely disinclined to practice it, but you're now living in a world where the non-physical has a reality and after death existence is a reality and all these pieces. That is a magical worldview. So everyone's a non-practicing magician in some respect.
Yeah, I get that. And I was just going to throw in one other example, because I think when we stick with religion, then there still are those same barriers and limitations that we have in terms of fitting it into our world. But I was going to take another example. Like, there's this motivational speaker, maybe you've heard about, he's probably one of the most famous motivational speakers. His name is Tony Robbins. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people don't like Tony Robbins or think that he's kind of cheesy or whatever. As someone who went to his seminars, followed him, and was extremely financially successful by following a lot of his techniques, I have nothing but great things to say about Tony Robbins and his firewalking and his other kind of things that are, in some sense, magical practices, in a way.
Literal sense, as far as I'm concerned.
So you break down what Tony Robbins is doing, and in one sense, it is literal. In another sense, it draws from cognitive behavioral psychology, which then we can say, is that also partially a magical practice? But then in another sense, I'll just give you a really kind of concrete story from the Tony Robbins group. Is you go and you do the thing and you've become financially successful just by goal setting. Hey, is goal setting magic, right? Goal study, goal setting, scientifically, like they've done at the Harvard Business School, and you'll find that people who set goals are dramatically more likely to achieve those goals, whether they do anything consciously to do it or not. Is this a form of kind of the secret wish fulfillment thing? We don't know. Is this magic? We don't know. But again, it's right there in front of our eyes. And a really dramatic example from the Tony Robbins thing was, he does this seminar and he says, hey, you know, whatever you want, you can get blah, blah, blah. And this one group in his seminar of several thousand people says, great, we want to win the lottery. And he's like, well, you know, it's more about, you know, kind of putting yourself in action. But he says, hey, I'm not going to, you know, squash that too much. Shorten the story a little bit. These people win the lottery.
Yeah.
He's blown away and he says, so now there's this group. So there's this whole group of people now who are trying to do it. These people in Michigan who did it initially win the lottery again. So they won the lottery twice. Now, is this magic? Is this cognitive behavioral psychology in action? It really stretches our understanding of what is really going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when it comes to practical enchantment, so the actual use of magic rather than living in a magical worldview, it's best described as probability enhancement. So that, to me, is a perfect example of an act of magic. Now, an act of magic doesn't need your candles and your grimoires and so on. You are doing something on a consciousness level that fundamentally changes the probabilities of your preferred outcome, which is why most, say, lottery spells don't work, because you have a 1 in 310 million chance of winning. If you drop that down to 1 in 50 million because you're an excellent magician, you're still left with 1 in 50 million odds. So the real art to using practical enchantment is to goal set in a way that breaks the probabilities so that they're as even as possible and then push on them on an individual basis. The goal setting is a fantastic example. The other ones that I think of that I know upset people in the general magical world is, I find it hilarious that companies run by people with deranged belief systems like, you know, Google and their whole transhumanist mind equals brain nonsense, they're actually embedding that, you know, meditation techniques. These are the popular things to have. And they're describing it to themselves in exclusively mind equals brain ways. And that that angers people. But I think actually if they're doing it, you end up with a sum greater than its parts effect. It's the same thing with goal setting. It's the same thing when you say have Elizabeth Targ's prayer trials for praying for people who didn't even know they were being prayed for. There are all these pieces that suggest that, I mean, we know the materialist explanation is wrong, but it doesn't matter. It can be from Tony Robbins to mindfulness in a corporate workspace. Their explanations for how it works is potentially necessary but not sufficient. And magic is that kind of blurry bit just beyond it where you go, well, something else is going on and I don't know what it is. And I guess magicians aren't as interested in, well, they might be as interested in finding the answer, but they're more interested in making that happen more often.
So what I think that you've done that is really terrific is you've taken that little kernel there, which is that magic is the only game in town because the materialistic reductionistic idea is proven to be bullshit. It's been falsified. So the only game left is magic. So what you've then done is taken that and say, okay, if that is a reality or some reality, you've said, let's kind of strip that away and see if we can trace that back to where the divide came, where the separation came between one set of data that says the world works one way and another set of data that says that the world works another way. And then what you're calling for, I think, in the book Starships is for this recalibration, a reexamining of the data and the interpretation of the data. Tell us about that, because it is a very broad scope that you're kind of taking there.
Yeah, it was one of those books that you accidentally, it didn't seem like it when I was planning it, but you accidentally kind of have to rewrite the history of mankind to get your point across because it kept going backwards and forwards. In terms of the separation of data and interpretation, this comes back to, and I think it's one of the reasons I love Skeptico, is that you are actually pro-science. You are pro the correct use of science because it is a remarkable way of discovering things about the universe. Unfortunately, the people who do the actual data analysis, so digging around in the dirt for little pot shards in Syria, are probably not the best people to put that, or there is no correlation between them being good at interpreting it just because they're generating the data. And when it comes to the story of mankind, it's fascinating if you sort of look at the history of science that we had some remarkable insights that came through sort of out of sequence. So geology kind of emerged and it ended mercifully. It ended a kind of biblical view that the world is only a few thousand years old and so on. But then it kind of reset the clock because the way they solved that was saying geologists said everything moves slowly. There was no flood. There was nothing. Geology is a very slow science. And so we got caught in the rain shadow of this for about 100 years and missed things like the dramatic end of the Ice Age and so on. Because when you start to understand how academia works as a model rather than individual academics, it's not very well set up to respond in even a remotely fast way to new information. And it gets caught in the politics of any other organization. I mean, it is literally modeled on the medieval church. So whilst you can get, and I did this, one of the things that it turned out, here's the trick if you want to know what actual historians think of history, go and buy them a drink. Because if you get them all in a room, they'll sing from the same hymn sheet, because for me, it's a hobby. For them, it's a job. And I'm asking them to essentially get themselves fired. But you go and buy them a drink and they're like, we don't know. Like, it's a guess that the pyramids were tombs. It's a guess at this. And there is this, which I'm sure you've experienced as well, but there's this kind of fascinating thing that happens to science. You turn it into individual scientists and the conversation suddenly becomes far more interesting. And I kind of had an emotional reaction to the idea that we have rendered over to a bunch of people who are officially materialists for their job, the interpretation of what I think is the most important story of mankind, which is the story of mankind, where we came from and how we interact with the world. And there's something hugely political about being able to tell your story, being able to tell your history, that is extremely disempowering if we don't take back. And if we don't take back in a coherent way, which means not throwing all of science out and kind of backsliding into barbarism, but actually go, okay, well, let's look at these data because your interpretation is fundamentally incorrect because it's this materialist nonsense. But nevertheless, you know, you did do this ice core dating and you did dig up these things. Like, you're in a materialist worldview doesn't have an impact on actual evidence, as I'm sure everyone listening to Skeptico knows. The evidence is there to be falsified or not, but the worldview or the belief you bring to it is an entirely other matter.
Yeah, one way you treat that in the book that I thought was kind of cool and really brought it home for me was in talking about Göbekli Tepe. And you add into that equation the Holy Land Syndrome. So maybe you want to tell people what that is, the Holy Land Syndrome.
Sure. So Dr. Klaus Schmidt, who is dead now, but he discovered Göbekli Tepe in the early 90s, he has a saying, well, he calls something Holy Land Syndrome, where if you look at the history of archaeology, it emerged out of what is essentially a hobby, like out of antiquarians. And it was basically a bunch of retired Anglican vicars. And they'd head out into Palestine or Israel or ancient Judea, and in Dr. Schmidt's words, with a Bible in one hand and a spade in the other, because they went digging, looking for things that happened in the document that they believed to be true. And Israel does this today for political reasons, because as you've had people on the show sort of talking about mythicism when it comes to Jesus and so on, a lot of the stuff, the mythology associated with the Bible isn't an accurate history. The stories are sort of tumbled down from times where they may have been, but the pieces just simply aren't there. So there's a hugely nefarious political motive to doing these things. The modern day version of that is, instead of going out with a Bible in one hand and a shovel in the other, you go out with kind of Darwin's On the Origin of the Species. So you have a shape of, you already know how you think humanity developed. So we got religion because we'd brought in all the corn or all the wheat, and we were sitting around the fire and decided to make up stories to tell each other, and that kind of gradual progression, which was sort of the brainchild of a guy called V. Gordon Child, who was an urban designer in the mid-20th century. And he had these very neat phases of what he thought all of mankind went through, from savagery to barbarism to civilization. And civilization was a culture that had writing. And obviously that kind of
And all of that can be measured by the stuff that you pile up, right? Yeah. So that's how we measure whether or not you're moving along that scale. I mean, that in and of itself is stunning in that it's obvious and yet we don't bring it to the surface. So again, the idea that civilization only moves down this one path from kind of barbarism to civilization, that all our technology came from one place over here where we found the Bible and all the rest of that stuff, and that we can measure it all by how much stuff we accumulate, not by our spiritual development or our ability to talk to spirit beings or any of that. We only measure it one way. What you do is make that explicit, and when you make it explicit, we go, wow, we already know that we might want to challenge some of that.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's a very fundamentally Anglo-centric idea that the apogee of civilization looked like London or New York in the mid-20th century. And that would, like, you know, brown people and yellow people and everyone are just sort of further back on this journey to having more stuff. And even though that idea, it's fascinating, I kind of call it the Jenga paradox, because even though that idea has been politically discredited in academia, so you won't find historians subscribing to this idea anymore because it's inherently racist. So that it's a Jenga paradox. So you've pulled the underlying assumptions out from the top of this materialist tower, but you've left the tower standing. So you've said, oh no. So hunter gatherers had the same rich inner imaginal life and songs and they grieved the same way when they had the same lives we did, if anything more complex, because their brains were literally bigger. But then we haven't actually taken that next step and said, all right, well then let's revivify the stories they told themselves. Let's actually look at them with the same seriousness that we look at stories of a civilization that runs on iPhones built out of slave labor.
Yeah, and that's another one of these paradoxes and recalibrations, rebalancings that you're calling for. And that's this postmodern idea that we cannot really measure things in the way that we thought we could because of we're so burdened by our prejudices that we have to look at things brand new. But that doesn't really work either.
No, exactly. The trouble with history is history keeps happening to it. And one of the things that happened as post-structuralism necessarily showed up, or postmodernism, and kind of dismantled the idea. They sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater, because it was sort of more expedient to say, oh God, a lot of the stuff we've just been teaching for 120 years is really quite racist, like extremely racist. So let's just say everyone independently invented everything. No one influenced each other. Everyone's equal. And it's kind of like a parent separating fighting children, like you over there, you over there. No touching. And
I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear who started it. I don't want to hear who hit first.
All right, I'm going to buy you both. I'm going to buy two of the one thing. And that was kind of like, okay, let's just do that and hope no one notices that is an absurd idea.
Exactly right.
So we get into the 21st century and people, some brave people, although it's academically brave. So I rely very heavily on a guy called Dr. Witzel, and I'll get to him in a second. But now people are starting to put their head above the parapet and go, well, actually, these two civilizations existed next to each other for 2,000 years. Is it too racist to say one influenced the other and the other one influenced and so on? Because that's kind of how the world works now with trade and culture and language and song. And so we're just getting back to realizing that the trouble with what was called the diffusionist model when it first arose in, say, the early 20th century was that the culture diffused from the areas that white people liked. So it diffused from the Fertile Crescent, the biblical bit. The shadow of the Bible was still there. And it diffused into India, and it diffused into China. And so you had this model of, well, smart people invented everything, and then it kind of moved off into the more savage races. Now, that didn't happen. But cultural contact does happen. And the recalibration, the opportunity to recalibrate we have in the last 10 years has arisen from the genetic information that not only can sort of track the story of mankind coming out of Africa, but can definitively prove that people in island Southeast Asia at bred with people who are in what is now the UAE or Turkey or so on. So we start to build, and this is what I mean by things come out of sequence, we start to build a map in time of population contact, which then invites us to look at the stories and mythologies of the cultures involved to see where that correlation is. Beforehand, it was kind of sticking your finger in the air and go, well, I quite like the Egyptians, so I'm going to say they were white rather than African, and they sort of taught the people all along the African coast everything they knew. And I like the Sumerians, so they can't be Semitic, and they invented stuff, and then that kind of spread through. And it was basically like that. Like, it's if you read an historical account from 120 years ago, it's alarming stuff. And we have the opportunity to go, well, hang on, we're in a situation where there are loan words, there is genetic information, and there are shared mythological motifs. And the opportunity is there to reconstruct and tell what I think is a very fascinating and crucially much, much older story of mankind's sort of answer to the eternal question of, well, why are we here and what is this place?
You have a great chapter title in the book that I think cuts right to that. The cathedral predates the city, right? So tell us about that and tell us what that means. And let's tie that back into Göbekli Tepe, because I think for people who don't know about Göbekli Tepe, it's extremely important. You do a wonderful job in the book of kind of going over some of the basics and then jumping off, using that as a jumping off point to really talking about some of the deeper implications for what that means. So do we want to try and pull that apart?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So in the materialist model of how cultures develop, you sort of have a materialist version of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So once everyone gets food, then we sort of – well, you sort of go from family groups to tribes, and tribes could get access to more resources. And then with more resources, they kind of built towns and granaries, and then the priests showed up to tell stories that keep everyone together, and then you build a little church or what have you.
This is the V. Gordon Child model, right? So it's when you build up enough momentum in your society, your hunter gathering, when you build up the stockpile over there, then you can start doing other stuff, and then you religion might spring forward from that. Blah blah blah. That's the narrative. How is that narrative completely blown apart by the data?
In this case, it's because Göbekli Tepe, which is, I mean, it's probably about 30 to 50 hectares all told, but it's 9 hectares now. It is essentially a star temple on a hill in southeast Turkey. And by we, I mean mankind, built this before we even lived in houses. So there are literally no structures that are as old as it. So we, for some reason, came together on a semi-regular basis to do things like trade and express our spirituality before we did anything else. So that's what the cathedral predates the city means. In the materialist model, the city comes first and the cathedral shows up because we started making stories up to control each other on a political basis. And that's where all of religion and spirituality comes from. But right there with the turn of the archaeologist's spade, it is completely upended. And in fact, the first thing we did was express our relation to the universe in a spiritual level. And it was probably from coming together to do that that cultural and technological information began to spread. It is the complete opposite, which interestingly aligns with the mythologies of the world, which is that, you know, the spirits or the angels taught us things like farming and metallurgy.
Yeah, which is a whole other thing we can get into, is that when we start cross-correlating the alternative view of this, everything lines up really nicely. But let's continue down the other path, because I was just going to throw in another tidbit, and I think you mentioned this in the book. As a matter of fact, I know you do. But we can also look at beyond these early civilizations, we can look at the Neanderthals and the other very early people that where we have the evidence that they were doing the same thing, right? They were doing these burial rituals, and they were giving people all sorts of fancy ornamentation on them when they buried, which again suggests that the cathedral predates the city. In another way, if the cathedral is the gravesite, that predates them. These are clearly hunter-gatherer people that clearly are spending just an inordinate amount of time on practices that are directly connected to this other dimension of consciousness of reality.
Well, absolutely. Technically the earliest sort of hominin expressions of spirituality are either, it depends, this is inside baseball stuff, but it depends what you think of the sort of red carved marks found in South Africa at the 200,000-year-old sort of layer. But the Neanderthal would put bones and skulls of bears in a circle around. And this one's quite tragic and heartbreaking in a way, because in this particular cave, it was the bones of a Neanderthal child have been found, and there's sort of remains of flowers and a circle of bear heads around it. So you're actually not only dealing with the idea that the cathedral predates the city, but you suddenly have a window into what is self-evidently the worst emotional experience a parent can go through tens of thousands of years ago. So the complexity of how we engage with the world and how we associate with loss and after death communication came first. Religion is not a farmer's hobby. It is the thing that one way or the other, and however it works, built the complexity of human culture that we see expressed today. It is the first thing we did.
It's an attempt to grapple with or understand, interact with a reality that is self-evident to these people. Mm-hmm. And yet we've somehow managed to suppress it and push it down and almost completely get it out of our culture. We're trying really hard. I mean, we're making a good go at it.
Yeah, we really are. A lot of money goes into defending that first domino. I mean, a lot of TV and everything goes into making sure that we – and it's like trying to keep a balloon underwater. It fascinates me because it doesn't I'm happy it doesn't work, but I actually sort of see at the moment on a cultural basis that disparity is extreme to breaking point in between the sort of former defense contractors that are trotted out on TV to tell you about quote unquote science and the lived experience of literally everyone else in the West becoming, dare I say, more paranormal or access to better information about consciousness studies and so on is there. And the split between the propaganda and the lived experience is extreme. And I don't recall it being this extreme before.
I have to agree with you. I'm usually not one to jump on these kind of broad cultural trends that are identified by people because I think so many times they don't bear out. But that one, gee, I mean, look at the list of the top 100 most popular films. You can't get past it. It's all about a magical world. It's all about an alternative reality. And then juxtapose that with what you're saying about what we're given as our modern culture, you know, the Kardashians and a Coke and a smile and just everything, you know, as you just said, the gap is stunning, and the way that it's growing just seems to be hard to understand.
Yeah, and well, it's hard to understand, I suspect, because the power structure doesn't know how to achieve its goals in a system that has decided on a grassroots basis to reprioritize. And that's why I think the propaganda is getting quite shill. Propaganda tends to fail before a regime change. And it's expressed everywhere. It's expressed in the widespread dissatisfaction with any of the kind of political structures you see around the world in Europe or the presidential elections or so on, because it's just, it's not working anymore. So they're shouting louder and louder. But the more they shout, the more this is my perception of it anyway, the more that there's a grassroots repositioning of, actually, I don't think this is what life is about. So it's potentially a very dangerous spot because people don't like to sort of relinquish power in a pleasant way. But this, to me, kind of speaks to not the politics of the book, but the philosophical implications of the book are, if you are feeling that, lean into it, because that is the probably that is the natural journey of a human, perhaps its own only journey, and it's certainly the first one, that that experience of you engaging with the universe and kind of working out what you're about and what's it about. It that's the journey.
So if that's the journey, and the journey is inherently a magical one, which is the case that you make, and I think you make quite convincingly, the question that I would still be left with is, what magic? Which magic do we choose? And why have you chosen? I know you're very interested in Renaissance magic. Why Renaissance magic? And which magic should we choose?
Look, it's flavors of ice cream. People can resonate for cultural reasons or for family reasons with what have you. I would recommend in an odd way, the only universal that people would may want to think of, and they probably have expressed in their house anyway, is some kind of ancestor veneration. Like, you know, it, and I'm talking like pictures of deceased family members on the mantle, just as a kind of remembrance piece, because that's probably the first religious belief we can find. But it's the one that provides the most, again, some greater than its parts, psychological benefit, and it allows you to kind of
reposition. But wait, Gordon, I mean, why would we not want to stop there? I'm really asking, I think, a bigger question. I really want to know why your flavor of ice cream appeals to you, because you've sold me on the idea that there are these different flavors, and that's all we're dealing with. As we talked about in our last conversation, we are essentially tinkering in the garage. We're not really going to change the fabric of the universe, but we are maybe going to change how we manipulate the different pieces we have in place. Why that flavor that you're choosing?
Well, my interest in Renaissance magic is because it was like a psychic breaking of the drought. So these banker families had enough money. So in North Italy, you have the Medici and so on, and they had enough money to do things like buy texts from the sort of the remnants of Byzantium, which had fallen by then. And this is the first time in, you know, almost 1,000 years that Plato was being read, that Hermetica showed up and was translated into Latin from Greek. So that was their moon landing, the rediscovery of the classical world. And it was that triggered, in the end, you end up with Galileo, you end up with the art of the Renaissance. It's a moment in time where the story of mankind sort of revivified in front of us, and the inspiration of that permanently changed culture. So, I picture and wonder what it would have been like when, you know, the horsemen with the actual first copies of the Corpus Hermeticum ever translated came galloping through Florence to the Palazzo Medici and to open them up. Cause the Medici, which one was it? It wasn't Lorenzo. Anyway, the head of the family was dying. And so he had the choice of getting his translator to translate all of Plato or the Corpus Hermeticum, which is a collection of texts from Alexandria, because he could only read one because he was going to die. And he stopped Plato and got to read the Corpus Hermeticum, or at least parts of it, before he died. And just that was their moon landing. That was their Tutankhamun tomb. That was their discovery of Göbekli Tepe. It repositioned humans in time and in the universe. So I find that a really compelling idea. Not necessarily their views of reality, but there is something about opening the mind, which is what I sort of hope we'll end up getting to now, historically speaking. There's something about opening the mind that has an effect on wider culture, where all of a sudden we have Copernicus and Galileo and Michelangelo. And so our inner world is rehydrated and our outer world gets more accurate, and suddenly we're in this universe orbiting the sun, and we're painting and writing and singing in different ways. It was remarkable, and it comes from this sort of little, not necessarily little, but a fairly innocuous thing, which is translation of what, in total, less than 1 million words.
So would it be fair to say then what you're trying to do is, as part of this recalibration of our history, do a redo on what that history really is about? And what has been missing is that magical perspective on what that history is. And since it's an experiential history, you have to be a practicing magician to really uncover some of those deeper truths. Are you a historian, an experiential historian? Is that your take on it? Or are you trying to do this to pick up chicks and get more dough?
Definitely not the last one. I wouldn't say it was a redo. I would say it's a reset, because when it comes to – because one, it's day one in this – in kind of looking at it. These sort of things I do hope to – you know, people will be looking at for quite some time. I don't mean my book. I mean everyone doing their own work, because two things have happened. So materialism has kind of trapped us into looking at the world in a complete, or the history in a completely wrong-headed way. And so the alternative response to that has been equally malformed. If you're only operating within a materialist paradigm, when you look at some of the fascinating things such as the pyramids or the rise of Sumeria, you go aliens, because that's still a materialist paradigm. That's still little green men in a physical spaceship coming down to teaching us how to build piles of pointy rocks. So it wasn't necessarily a redo as much as it is a reset to say, well, let's reposition these hypotheses based on what we now do know, the geological and linguistic and genetic information and the psi information, the consciousness stuff and Dr. Vallée's work, and go from there. Because it's not necessarily selling an answer as much as it is resetting a lot of the sort of malformed modes of thinking that are a direct result of materialism kind of squatting over the question.
I totally get that. I guess what I'm asking, and I don't know the answer to this, is being a practicing magician part of that reset, part of that rediscovery?
No, I don't. No, not at all. What is, though, is having some kind of inciting incident. Basically, I want people to finish the book and know they live in, you know, an animate, magical, non-materialist universe. I want them to know that the universe is a lot bigger than what, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson will tell you.
And I think you want them to know, more importantly, I think you want them to know the implications for daring to make that intellectual step off the cliff and say that it is more. Because I think that, as we've explored so many times on the show, is that's a lot bigger step than we sometimes want to acknowledge.
No, absolutely. And people will listen to it and go, right, I'm convinced. Or, you know,
right,
I'm convinced on after-death communication. And then if you go and you go, no, pause and just sit a while and think about what that is.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm convinced of it. Now hand me my iPhone so that I can get my Uber and go where I need to go.
And for me, and this is kind of what I recommend when people, which doesn't happen that often because, again, niche interest in the garage. But if people are like, so how do you get into this magic thing? And literally the only answer, and it's not even just for magic, it's basically how you get into a magical universe and stay there, is to have some kind of extreme event. I mean, Whitley Strieber had one without wanting to. It can be that. It can be living in a haunted house. It can be a nice thing as well. It can be, you know, your deceased grandmother appearing recently after her death in you know, in a room with other people and, you know, saying her goodbyes and I love you. But you need an event that through the process of time, that won't be dissolved. That won't just sort of dissolve. Like, oh, did I really think that or not? You need like a character in a novel. You need an inciting incident where you go, right, so the universe is a lot bigger. My sort of realization subsequent to that is, okay, kind of like Alan Moore, the comic book writer, on his 40th birthday, he kind of reached the conclusion that you can only be a magician when when you get there, which is not true. People can be what they want to be. But my response to an extreme paranormal event is, right, so the universe is bigger. This is a way of exploring and playing with it and expressing my contact with it. But the book is very much designed so that you can look at history and realize that the same kind of mystery that we can experience or search for today has probably been the defining kind of quest of mankind. So I actually think, like, the question rather than the answer is, is the answer, if that makes sense. The famous Mircea Eliade, who was a very famous 20th century anthropologist, said that all creation myths around the world are trying to explain the question of self-consciousness, of why do I have an eye and that tree doesn't. So creation myths are trying to solve what Skeptico is trying to solve. And it's really nice to be able to look back. I find comfort in being able to look back over essentially 70,000 years of human history and go, well, they're dealing with it as well. They're dealing with grief and spirit contact and telepathy and this much bigger, richer tasting, exciting universe, just as we are or can be. And also it's okay if you don't have the answer because, you know, we've been looking for 70,000 years.
So, Gordon, again, the book is Starships. We haven't had a chance to talk about the UFO connection. You teed up that little bit there that I think is interesting, and we could go off on a whole show about that, and maybe we will, because the only issue I guess I have with that is we do have a lot of evidence that these starships have a reality to them, too. So we're going to have to somehow fit that reality into what, in a lot of cases, is clearly a misidentification of those same objects. But I think we will have to leave that for another time. This has been a pretty dense interview. I hope it wasn't too much inside baseball. And I really hope that you will pick up this book because I dare say it's an important book. It really, really is an important book in laying out this terrain in a way that I haven't seen it done before. So you're definitely to be congratulated for it, Gordon. And thanks again so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thanks again to Gordon White for joining me today on Skeptico. Here's a question to tee up from this interview. What do you think about Gordon's claim that we're all magicians, either practicing or non-practicing magicians? Is a magical worldview a more accurate interpretation of what we are experiencing? Let me know your thoughts. The place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can jump on over to the forum where we usually have quite a lively discussion about this. On the last two shows, there's been over 200 comments. So if you're looking for a conversation about the show, that's probably the best place to go. You do have to send me a little email because, like all forums, it's susceptible to spamming. But if you just send me a little note and say you'd like to join the forum, then we manually add you and you're in, and then you can comment away and a lot of times have a great discussion about these topics. I know, as I've said many times, I benefit and have learned so much on the forum. We really attract a great group of very sharp people who have a lot to bring to these conversations. So if you're at all inclined, and it's not an intimidating thing, you don't have to be at the top of your game to post something on the forum. But if you think that's something that's interesting, please check it out. And of course, while you're at the Skeptico website, be sure to subscribe to the show or download any of our over 300 previous episodes of Skeptico. They're all there for free. There's no donation. There's no advertising, none of that. Just good information to share, good data to follow wherever it leads. Well, I have a number of interesting shows coming up on Skeptico. I keep saying that I can't keep up this once-a-week pace, but that day never seems to come, so we'll just see what the future brings. But I do have some good shows in the hopper that I'm anxious to bring to you, and I do hope you stick around for all of them. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.